Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Welcome to the LSE, or welcome to this room if you are part of the LSE already. My name is Alexander Evans. I'm a professor in practice in the School of Public Policy. And it's my pleasure to host you this evening for this hybrid event, hosted jointly by the LSE School of Public Policy, but also by LSE Cities, which is this real anchor of work on cities and urban policy. Very pleased to be joined by Marvin Rees, OB, Mayor of Bristol, sitting up the stage for this event. And he's for talent, so the main reason you're here, obviously, is to hear what he has to say. And there'll be a chance to ask questions of him, as well as hear his prepared remarks. Obviously, it's right and proper for me to do the usual administrative things. I'm a recovering diplomat, so red tape and rules are very important to me, as I'm sure they are to each of you. So I do just want to ask you, for those of you in the auditorium, to put your phones on silent, please, so that you know the glorious rendering of your favourite phone ringtone doesn't intrude on the evening. This event is being recorded and it will hopefully be made available as a podcast and a YouTube video, subject to no technical difficulties. As usual, there will be a chance to put questions to the speaker. We'll do that for those online, and welcome to our online participants. That will be via the Q&A feature at the bottom of your screen. Please do include your name and affiliation if you wish to. And for those of you here in the auditorium, there will be a roving mic. We will pick questions in the room and invite you to address them. Please do wait for the mic to arrive. Otherwise, there's that sort of awkwardness of something happening on an island far away that may or may not be a question and cannot be heard. And for those of you who are still on X, the site formerly known as Twitter, the hashtag for today's event is hashtag LSE Bristol. So I won't say a huge amount on the event, but obviously I think for anybody working on public policy, running a city is about as hard as it gets. It covers every aspect of public policy. You're at the sharp end of delivery. There's always a squeeze on money. And you're close enough and up personal with your constituents that when things go wrong, you're easily kind of pointable at in terms of citizens who want to get some form of redress. So I'm very delighted that we are joined by Marvin Rees. Marvin's the elected mayor of Bristol, and he was first elected mayor in May 2016. On that day, Bristol became the first major European city to elect a black mayor, a key moment not just for European cities, but also for Bristol itself, given Bristol's own history and past. He describes becoming mayor as another expression of a deeper commitment to building a fairer and more inclusive world. Marvin began his professional life working with Tier Fund, one of the UK's leading development agencies, before working in the US with Sojourners, a Washington DC-based social justice organization. He has worked for the BBC as a broadcast journalist, and with the Black Development Agency supporting black and minority ethnic-led voluntary sector work, and in NHS Bristol's public health team on race equality in mental health. He's also been a Yale World Fellow, which I have also been. And I think, Marvin, it's probably the moment just to recall, because you were in the year that Alexei Navalny was in as well. I think you were a close neighbour of Alexei's during his time at Yale. And it's worth just pausing to note that we're lucky enough to be hearing from Marvin this evening. Unfortunately, we're not going to be lucky enough to hear from Alexei Navalny any time again. Let's just turn on without further ado. And Marvin, the floor is yours. Do you want to speak from up there or do you want to speak from here?
I'll speak from here, if that's
excellent.
All right.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to come and join you next door to you.
Okay.
Marvin, the floor is yours.
All right. Well, thanks very much. So I'm going to format a little bit from me and then questions. I always think that the question in back and forth is more interesting than someone just pronouncing. So I'll try and keep it at quite tight. I'll talk a little bit about me and my background because that is important. Not least because becoming mayor of my Bristol, it felt like they mugged me of my history. Suddenly this thing that you are just a politician. And I said, no, I'm a human being occupying a position in public life for a period in time. I'm still me. So I'll talk a little bit about me because that influences the way I've approached leadership in Bristol. I'll tell you a bit about Bristol. There are some insights into lessons of leading a city. I don't think they're particularly profound, but they have been very important to me about how you lead that particular place. And then maybe something about the future of cities and in the world. So look, I share my background. I was born in 1972, the brown skin child of a single white woman. And for those of you who know your social history in the UK, that was not a done thing. So when my mum found out she was having me, and I share this is very personal, but it is real. The first advice she had from the health worker was if she was a good woman, she would have me aborted. And then when I was born, if she was a good woman, she'd give me up for adoption. And my years living in Bristol echoed those experiences, right? I've just recently written a book, and it will be out in the summer. But actually, what I discovered during the writing of the book that actually a lot of my political motivation was not about my experiences directly; it's about my mum's experiences and me living through my mum. And so I grew up in Bristol through the 70s. It was not unusual. I knew even as a child that people looked on me in a certain way. You know, this is National Front on the rise and all that. And I felt the vulnerability of my white mum with this brown liability in her life that she has to keep me safe. Move into the 80s when you start to come of age. We have the riots, across the UK. And I remember these riots. And then the 1981 riot in Bristol, St. Paul's riot, I was actually out inviting children to my birthday party. And it kicked off. And we get home quickly. And the second riot, I was coming home from school and we could see all the activity. So we went over to Grosvenor Road. We knew it was going to go on. And we sat there. And as soon as the first bottle started, we said, oh, let's go home. And so we went home. So I grew up like that, and it was not unusual for people to chase me and my friends down the street or men to drive past us in the car and shout racial slurs at us. But I'll share another experience again, which fits into my relationship to politics. As a 13-year-old, I was walking to school one day, and my black friend said to me, so Marv, in a war between black and white, whose side are you going to be on? All right, so now you've got, I'm illegitimate, where's my racial identity? We're poor. And so I grew up in this city that had lots of money in certain parts, and I felt like I had no place in it. And that is my approach to politics. That has actually really been a huge theme in my approach to politics. So just kind of hold on to that when we start thinking about Colston statue, identity, belonging, complexity, and racial and class fractures in Bristol, you know, as well. Now, for Bristol itself, we have to get to the idea there is a thing here, there is a city, and it is a thing. It's 42 square miles. We have 472,000 people living there today. It was 460 when I was first elected. But in the next 27 years or so, 26 years, we're supposed to be at 550,000 people. That population is growth is happening in a city with entrenched inequalities. So in Bristol West, around Clifton, nearly on 100% of teenagers go on to higher education. If you go to an area like Hartcliffe, it's about 11%. Hartcliffe, white working class. Right? So you get those inequalities existing within this really tightly bound area. And it's actually been a big part of our leadership, I would say, to be honest about those. When you talk about a city that lives with these contradictions, this fantastic story to tell to the outside world, two world-class universities, thriving financial sector, over a third of the world's natural history broadcasting coming out of the city, you know, foodie city, a city that's a foodie city in over 20% of children are at risk of hunger every day. And if they are eating, they could still be in nutritional poverty. All these contradictions living within that city. And we have to meet the needs of that growing population within those 42 square miles. Sorry, and what I add to the crisis of most cities, 22,000 people on our housing waiting list, 1,200 to 1,300 households in temporary accommodation right here, right now. And so we have to meet the needs of that population within those 42 square miles in the context of a climate and ecological emergencies that we're facing as well. And to me, that's these are the entrenched dilemmas that we face as a place. And we've taken those challenges on since 2016 in a really interesting political context, right? So since I was elected, I've had 5 prime ministers, 8 secretaries of state. I took up austerity in its 6th year, and I've lived it to its 14th year now. All right, so the constant pressure on local government finance. I came into office, the first thing to hit me big when I came into office was the Brexit referendum result. So I was elected, next count I went to, we were watching the Sunderland result come in, and then we were out. My wife's actually American, and we woke up that morning to the news, and she said, does that mean we're going to get Trump? I said, no, not that stupid. Well, excuse me, any Trump fans out there? We've had that. Then obviously we went into COVID, global pandemic. We come through that cost of living crisis, and that we're still living way today. And that sits on top of the ongoing stresses that we have in our city, those entrenched inequalities, race and class fractures, the housing crisis, and all those things that are winding up. And you know, during my time, if I think about the key events as well, there are some that will be known to you, some that will not be known to you. It's always a dilemma when you start to build homes. Most people are like, we must tackle the housing crisis, but not near me. I want you to tackle the housing crisis, but I do not want height, right? Even though I don't want you to sprawl either. I had the Colston statue incident, and I'm really happy to take questions about that, because there are lots of layers to that, by the way, that could be peeled off. And obviously, we've done our best to tackle the cost of living crisis in an arena, you know, as well. So lots of stuff swirling around that, in terms of my approach to leadership, it's taken a real sense of adaptability. And I guess one of the first lessons of leadership I'd share in that context is a bit of a West Wing lesson. Any West Wing fans? I realize it's a very old series now. But when I was very first selected, I came up to London. There's a guy called Richard Angel, who used to run Progress. And he said to me, now you're selected, you need to watch West Wing. There's an episode where Bartlett meets a young representative, and he said to him, have you got a best friend? He said, yeah. He said, is he smarter than you? He said, yeah. He said, you trust him with your life? He said, yeah. He said, that's your chief of staff. And the key kind of lesson for me on coming in is to be very aware of my own limitations and to build a good team, right? That's not rocket science, is it, right? It's to build the smart people around you. Now, off that, some of the specifics. Before I was elected, it was Steve Bullock, I think it was, said to me that when he was elected mayor of a London borough, he walked into his office and he had all these levers in front of him, metaphorical levers, obviously. And what he found was when he pulled on them, they weren't actually connected to anything. So our point was, and he said, what you got to do is find someone to come into your office who will connect your political commitments and your manifesto to the machinery that you now have somewhat at your disposal, because it is not totally at your disposal. And I think one of my reflections at the end of my 8 years, because I finished as mayor in May, is we didn't get things done because we fixed the local authority. Sometimes you're just jamming stuff through a system that doesn't want it to happen. And so actually my chief of staff and Simon in the front row here, they're all part of the team that has worked so hard to make sure that what we've wanted to get done, we want to be ambitious for Bristol, we've wanted to tackle entrenched inequalities, and even when we can't do for things for people, we've wanted to treat them with respect. So I've said to people, even if we say no, you must come away from that interaction knowing that you're respected and valued, the intensity, you know, of that relationship, to make sure that the culture we want, the delivery we want in local government is attached to the machinery of local government. Because what we certainly have found with the machinery, and I guess any national government will find this as well, is that there are lots of fiefdoms and ways of doing things. One of the most frustrating phrases I have that comes my way is when we say, well, why can't we do that? Well, we've never done it like that. Is there a law against it? We've never done it like that. Can we do it like that? Maybe. You know, and so you're constantly driving. We face this around housing delivery, for example, and we've started to look at off-site manufactured homes, modern methods of construction, built in a factory, clipped together on site. We ended up with an award-winning scheme, Z-Pods. We had an open car park next to a park, and we built 11 homes on stilts above the car park. So the car parking spaces are still there, but we've got these 11 homes. We linked up with the YMCA. We've got young people who would otherwise highly likely be homeless living in these net zero homes now. Innovation, but it wasn't easy to get through. I think the second thing I would say, a real big insight, is interdependence of local leadership. I come from a public health background, and health outcomes are not the result of any single organization's decisions. And we said that what people receive from Bristol is not the result of any single organization's decisions. As a mayor, I do not have command and control power over Bristol. There are many points of sovereignty. The National Health Service is its own city within Bristol. Our universities are small towns in Bristol. You've got the private sector. And it was Andy Marsh, my former chief constable, the former chief constable, said, world-class public sector leadership is not about what you command and control. It's what you can convene and ask and influence. And within a month of getting elected, I convened a meeting of all of the leaders of the key institutions across Bristol, public sector, private sector, higher education. Importantly as well, I brought unions in, who often left out, faith groups, who are massive shapers of place, the voluntary community sector. Now, it was interesting. Our budget it was just over £1 billion, about £1.1, £1.2 billion local government, right, in a city with a £15 billion economy. Now, I said to those leaders in that room after we'd done some work that my office, Simon and others, done a back of the envelope calculation. 70 people turned up to that first meeting. Our collective financial presence in Bristol was about £6.5 billion. Right? As between us, we employed 70,000 people. Now, it's embarrassingly simple what we did, but no one had done it before. So I said to those people in that room, this is what we are. This is the presence we have. If we, in this room, many people paid over £150,000 a year, right? Got ourselves together and decided to focus on a small number of shared priorities for the city. Doesn't mean we abandon our wider agendas or our core purpose, but if we decided we would rally around child hunger, for example, reducing domestic violence, right? Increasing street safety, cleanliness, housing delivery. And we were to say we were gonna bring our collective firepower to solving those challenges. What could we not do? That became the heart of what now known as the Bristol One City approach, whereby we have rallied those key institutions. We have written a city plan that goes up that focuses on a statement that we collectively made about what we want Bristol to be by 2050. And then we've identified a sequence of outcomes and programs that we must deliver every year to become that city by 2050. Now, in that plan, we say it's not perfect. We review it every 2 years. But it's a focus, and it brings all those institutions to focus. And that's about us trying to really rally that interdependence. And that interdependence is also a recognition that no single organization could be successful in an abstract. So AWP, our mental health provider, someone goes into section, they come out. The likely recovery of the mental health is not down to just down to the quality of psychiatric care they had when they were sectioned. Do they have a home? Do they have social support? Do they have quality employment? So if we all rally our collective resources within that finite place, that's how we begin to really take control of what we do. And by the way, talking to another World Fellow, Martin Sturgeon, who was on a World Fellows program in 2012, was an ex-army officer. A lot of people get nervous about making a plan and 25 years ahead. Martin's point that I make often is, make a plan, any plan, just make a bloody plan. And so we put something in place for us to point to. And the last insight I would share that the city really that we really push the city to cope with is complexity. And one of those complexities is that good things can have negative consequences for some people. That's a really hard thing for me as a city leader to navigate, because the public narrative is always about the negative thing and not about the win we get. So I'll give you an example. 42 square miles, we have to solve the housing crisis. You've got a decision. If you're gonna build homes, you have to build them somewhere. Right? If you're going to focus on brownfield sites, which we want to, and we think we should, every home you do not put on top of that brownfield site, you have to find another piece of land to put it on. Or you don't build it at all. But the big pushback is always, we don't want tall buildings in Bristol. Great, but where are you going to go? So if a full council meeting, I had three public statements made to me. One person said, do not build on new land, Marvin, protect land for nature. The other two people clapped. Then the second statement said, solve the housing crisis. The other two people clapped. What did the third person say? Do not build tall buildings in Bristol. So I said, you all need to talk to each other. Because if you're not going to sprawl, we need to build in and up. But actually, these are the kind of dilemmas, you know, within the city that we rarely are grappling with the idea that with finite resources, finite land, that there is no solution that comes without a price to be paid. But that inability to have that nuanced conversation around that complexity is one of the things that really does hold back city leadership, you know, and delivering. Dare I say as well on that front that we never really solve our problems, but again, we can get into that, you know, in some of the discussion. Now, if I say a little bit about the future of cities before we go into the conversation, what are the challenges for us? I think the challenges for cities are pretty much standard that we're facing Bristol, as I described. Finite areas, limited resources, rapidly growing populations, how people live together, sometimes seeing other people coming and competing for limited resources. Housing is a flashpoint for us within Bristol. I looked on the comments today on one of the stories, and the comment was about, all you do is take care of migrants, you're not taking care of our own, you know, they're taking our house. It's a classic 1970s, they come over here, take our jobs and our houses and so forth like that. I've got to find a way of the city living in peace and communicating around the challenges of limited resources with growing need, but finding a way of talking about that, that means that we don't end up with relatively poor and powerless people blaming other relatively poor and powerless people for why their lives are the way they are, and looking at the context in which we live. At the same time as doing that, what I don't want to do and I can't do as a city leader is simply spend my time moaning about why things are bad, because the day-on-day demand on me as a city leader is to come up with solutions. And actually, there's one of the real sharp points of contrast, I think, with national government, and I will just make this. It strikes me that national government get away with announcing pots of money. What did you do about this? Well, here's a big sum of money. Yeah, but how did you apply it? What does it mean? It's the abstractness of that kind of leadership, as opposed to the actual need to deliver at the city level, I find absolutely painful, actually, and incredibly frustrating. Again, we can grow more about that. I think too, at the moment, what Greg Clark, Professor Greg Clark, will talk about is attached to LSE and the Cities Programme as well, is that, you know, this is the age of the city, and I think there's a couple of reasons for that. Not least because of the mathematics of it. We're now an urban world. I think 2/3 of the world will be living in cities by the middle of this century. So if we want to do things, and I gave a TED talk a few years ago, and shared this, through cities we can reach more human lives more quickly than we can through any other form of human organisation at the moment. If we solve the issue of cities on poverty, on decarbonisation, on increasing efficiency, we need less resources to sustain our lifestyles, then actually we've made a big chunk in tackling the global problem. And I think what we need to see and what we are seeing is more cities taking agency over their own futures, because the national context in which we work is not tuned in to working with and supporting city leaders to get that delivery. In the UK, I've just been involved in a piece of work with the RSA, which is called the Urban Futures Commission. And we've really set out a map, a plan for the UK cities, because remarkably in the UK, there is no national plan for the UK cities. Considering most people live in cities, it's absolutely remarkable. There's no plan for thinking about what is Bristol, what is Liverpool, what is Manchester, what are they within the nation, the culture, the politics, the economy. There's no plan that really sets out what the country needs those cities to be in terms of their economic strength, in terms of their density, their ability to host population. And as a consequence, there is no plan for helping those cities become what we need them to be, which strikes me as an incredible oversight. And not necessarily my favorite image, but I did throw it around once. It's like having these superstar players on the touchline, but you're not putting them on the field of play. You've got these incredible national assets with no framework. So what we're finding in the UK and overseas is cities are actually stepping into their own agency, forming city networks, finding philanthropists are also engaging with cities, international organizations are trying to engage with cities because they can see that level of drive to deliver and make stuff happen and to work with us. So on that sense of, which I think is an underperforming national and international context, cities stepping into that vacuum of leadership, but also the sheer math that if cities are going to work for the interests of people within their boundaries, they have to be shaping the national and international context in which they work. I think one of the things that we need at the moment is the national and global governance to move into a shape where it can actually begin to work and harness and support that city agency. But that's probably enough for me.
Marvin, thanks very much. So, so what we're going to do is have a little bit of a chat up here. I promise not to do the abusive role that chairs often do, which is just have a chat. And then we'll come back to you never. So we'll do that briefly. And I did just want to perhaps kick off, Marvin, with something on the money. Because there's always been this debate about UK local government struggling, both cities and local government struggling, because actually so much of the revenue base, so much of the fiscal power lies at the centre of government in London, rather than with cities. We've seen a range of press stories in the last couple of years, looking at Croydon, looking at the debate about Teesside, where cities have innovated around their finances, not necessarily always in a very healthy manner. We are looking at a baseline for council tax that is still based, if I remember rightly, in the early 1990s in terms of valuations on properties. And you've also seen Sadiq Khan here in London grapple with sort of ULEZ and also road pricing as another form of revenue raising and of environmental change in the city. So I just wondered on the money side for a moment, if you'd like to reflect on what are some of your reflections on what urban leaders can do, given money so tight, given money so centralised, and money, you know, and money is needed to generate new initiatives.
If I do the context first, and then because then we do need to talk about what the solutions we've tried to engage in. There is, I mean, it's just been absolutely brutal. One of the first presentations I had after getting elected was, you need to find £40 million, right, from our revenue. And that's been the story every year. We've had eight balanced budgets during my time, which has been actually quite an achievement, particularly when my colleagues in Nottingham, Birmingham, two fellow core cities have filed 114s for bankruptcies. And one of the conversations I've had with the city is, I think historically people have taken it for granted that there's some money somewhere in local government, as though there was a bag of money we were holding back. And I've said, look, you have to take seriously now the possibility that your local government doesn't actually have any money and could go effectively bankrupt, follow 114. That is the new reality. We control a remarkably small amount of our budget. It's around about 5%, really, in terms of what we get. We are, you know, famously, people cite us as one of the most centralized countries in Europe for control. And what that really does is really holds back our ability to be a dependable partner. Because within that as well, the financial model is broken. It's short term. So we get an announcement each year on what our settlement for that year will be. It comes in quite late in the financial term when we're trying to work out what we can do with our money. By the way, and the knock-on effect of that is that we want to be a dependable local partner. Local government needs to be a strong local partner for our business, particularly for our voluntary sector as well. But when you undermine our ability to forecast and say what we're going to be this year, next year, we become a less dependable local partner because we could get a shock at the last minute, you know, as well. So it leaves everyone asking. And you know, a big piece of work a big message we've been driving to government as well is you've got to get beyond this short-term competitive funding round. So again, the model seems to be government announce a pot of money and then they say to local government, there you go, fight for that. And then we're in a zero-sum fight against other authorities. There was an announcement a few years ago of an £8 million pot to tackle child hunger and eight cities were going to get it. Now, eight cities got it. We didn't get it. We missed that by a couple of points. But that doesn't mean we don't have child hunger, right? It just means that we didn't get any support to tackle our child hunger. Interestingly, what we then did was we convened a meeting with our businesses within the city under that one city approach and said, actually, what happens to our children is a collective responsibility. So we didn't get the money, but what can we do? And in that morning over at Burgess Salmon, which has been a really good city partner law firm, actually, we raised £125,000 and we used that money to provide about 60, 70,000 meals during those summer holidays to tackle the holiday hunger. So what we've had to really do is hustle and improvise to try and raise money within from other sources. The other problem with that short-term competitive funding model is that local authorities spend a lot of money bidding for resources. So the leader of Birmingham will share that the second round of levelling up, I think they put their bid cost over £20,000 to put together. Well, if you don't win, you've wasted £20,000. If you don't bid, you may have missed out on, you know, millions of pounds. So, you know, it's a gamble. And then it's a question of, well, who bought the best bid writers in, right? Are your team good at writing bids, or do you have to get the consultants in from the KPMGs or the PwCs to do it for you? And then they turn up in your budget and people say, why are you employing these consultants? And you have to explain that this is the way you get money. If I just add one of the hidden costs of austerity and that financial crisis, by the way, is this. There's a really nice line in local government that people like to hear. We're protecting frontline services. People love frontline services, don't they, right? So down at City Hall, it's like a protest a month, and I'm not decrying the importance of protest. It's a really important part of our politics and our democracy, but we get a lot of them in Bristol. At parks, libraries, public toilets, I've never had a protest for an accountant or a planner or an architect or a project manager. And yet, what do? Projects, planners, architects, accountants, they keep the cogs of a place moving. So if we want to deliver thousands of homes, and we've delivered 12,500 homes, in my 8 years, that takes people who were not campaigned for. You know, if we want to make sure that our send services are running well behind the scenes, if we want to be in the position where you could bid for money, we've just done a deal with Ameresco, energy company, and Vattenfall, which is the first of its kind. It's a public-private finance deal that's unlocked £1 billion of investment into our energy system over the next 20 years. And actually, I just got a report today. It's 700 million now over the next 5 years to decarbonize our energy system. That's a deal between us and the private sector. That took planners, project managers, lawyers, accountants pouring over the details. Now, if we were trying to do that deal today, we wouldn't be able to afford to do it, even if we knew what the prize was, because that backroom capacity of local government has been hollowed out. And it's going to take a lot to fill that back in to get local government working at the level at which the country's going to need it.
And Marvin, can I just press you? Because obviously one of the tricky politics on this would be, I seem to remember something called poll tax caused a little bit of local difficulty in the politics for one particular government a few decades ago. But to properly rebaseline council tax in the UK, which I think many people at technocratic level would say kind of makes sense, it might make technical sense, it doesn't make much political sense. Mm. So how do you actually rebaseline the fundamental property tax system that at least is one revenue source for local government?
Yeah, well, I was listening to a New Statesman podcast on the crisis of local government finance. It was why are so many local governments going bust? And one of the things they said is no one's touching local taxation, and neither am I. One of the points, and it comes back to that point of complexity, right? Good things can have negative consequences for some people, and there'll always be losers. I would say, though, that actually when we were at Yale, one of the things that we went for breakfast with Stanley McChrystal, and one of the things that he said was that the price of getting involved in public life has become so high that good people just won't do it, right? Now, here's where I would say a mix of public commentary, and by that I mean journalists and social media, and the public are co-responsible for the politics we get, right? So I think often people point to politicians, you're debasing us, you're dragging us down. Actually, politics maybe is a distilled reflection of what we are as a society. Anyone who steps across that line to start messing with that, what's the headline they're going to get? Is there going to be a nuanced, qualified debate that says, yeah, there is a price to be paid, but this is, I just don't think that we have got ourselves into a position where we can have that kind of conversation, which leaves politicians terrified. Now, you can't blame politicians for that, you could have a stab at it, but they'll also be saying, okay, these are all the good things I want to do. If I touch that and I become incredibly unpopular, I give up these things as well, these outcomes. I might want to do stuff on child hunger, the housing crisis. The price I will pay to keep myself in a position of power so I can do stuff about the housing crisis and entrenched inequalities is not to touch local taxation. These are the trade-offs. It's not, doesn't make them all cynical and power hungry, although some will be. So I think unless there's a maturing of the way we do political debate, and again, that's social media, that's journalism, and it's what the public click on, I just don't think there'll be space to have that conversation that is, and that policy review, which is so desperately needed.
Marvin, you've spoken very openly and sensitively, I think, about your personal journey as a Bristolian and as mayor of Bristol. Bristol itself has a complex history, right? There's the history of slavery, there's a history of inequality, there's a history of different Bristols within one city. Do you perhaps want to talk a little bit about that? Because, Marvin and I were talking earlier, I lived in Bristol in the 1980s and returned there briefly in the mid-1990s. Bristol today is a very different city to what it was in the 1980s. But how have you navigated some of that, and perhaps thinking particularly about some of the racialized history and the history of slavery that Bristol's had to contend with?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really broad field. But if I were to zoom in, maybe kind of a nice entry point for that, it would be the Colson statue incident, right? Because a lot of people saw that happen. I mean, I was actually out walking my children, and I got a text saying there's like 10,000 people in the center of the city. And I get another text 10 minutes later saying they got ropes around the statue. It's like, okay. Another text saying they pulled the statue down, and then it was in the harbor. And I was asked on Channel 4 News that night. They said, "So Marvin, do you?" It's a kind of classic binary question, right? Do you support the hauling down of the statue, or do you think that they should be kind of pursued for the full force of the law?" And my point was that Christian Gurmuth, I said, the problem is your question is too binary. The world's complicated. I'm descended from enslaved Africans, Jamaican. Colston may well have owned one of my ancestors, right? Do I want a statue of a slaver up in the middle of the city? No, I don't. All right? Is it offence to me? Yeah. But I'm also the mayor of Bristol. I can't condone people hauling statues down, right, like that. I can't. But at the same time, I can't not see the poetry of it. the fact that the statue was essentially lynched, right? Pulled down, rolled through the streets, and, by the way, thrown into the very harbour where Colston's ships moored. Now, and my point was, in terms of navigating those things, I think one of the points I've made repeatedly within Bristol is lots of things can be true at the same time that are very difficult to reconcile. And I'm just not going to, and I'm just going to sit in that place and just say, do you know what, it's all true and it's very difficult to hold together, and we're just going to have to try and, find a way through. In terms of the statue, what happened as well, and I'll give you a story. And again, anyone can ask me about that if you want, right? Because the people that pulled the statue down, by the way, one of the points I made was, and excuse my categorizations here, but this is where it was. Four middle-class white people hauled the statue down on camera, premeditated, in front of police, and then they asked for a Crown Court trial and defended themselves, saying the kind of statue offended my sensibilities. So, and then they were held up as a champion of tackling racism. So I said, they met me once, and I said, "Do you think four black people would have done that?" "Well, no, they wouldn't." To have the confidence of doing that on camera in front of police and stand in court and expect to get not guilty on no. So I'm not saying they're bad, but to then just say, "Well, we are the high front, Marvin, you should have done this, that, and the other." I said, "Well, maybe there's a little bit of an exercise of white privilege here, all right?" But actually, more interesting than actually what happened with the statue, I think, was maybe what happened the week after. And I liked hearing this story. So the week after, there was what they called a counter rally, right? And football firms turned up. One guy phoned up five football firms, right? Hooligans, right? And they phoned up the Hells Angels, and they all turned up, and they protected the cenotaph. So I was watching this gathering, and I looked at it, and I thought, "Oh, God, it doesn't look good." And there were people saying, "You racist scum," and, choice language and all that, and they were chatting and swearing. But I looked at this, I thought, it's not simply a far-right event here. And my cousin used to be a bit of a football lad. So I phoned up my cousin. I said, do you know the guy that organised it? He said, yeah. I said, could you put me in touch with him? He said, I'll try. So anyway, I ended up with the phone number of the guy that phoned up all these football firms and got them to come to Bristol. So this guy's, you know, serious guy. I phoned him up and we ended up talking. And his opening speech to me was, his opening gambit to me was, he said, I'm not far right. And I said, I'm not saying you were, but I need to know what's going on. You know, I'm keen to talk to you. So anyway, long story short, I went round his house. Myself, my cousin, and my chief of staff, white working class guy. And as I arrived, he handed me a paper, and it talked about working class history in a football firm. Very well written, super smart guy. Like, you know, scaffolder, football firm leader, but like hyper intelligent. And we talked about housing policy. He supported it. We talked about the work we've done around child hunger. He supported it. And we talked about policy. He was fantastic, right? And then I said to him, tell me, what's going on for the guys that turned up at the Cenotaph? And he said to me, Marv, they feel like they're losing their city. And I said, they are losing their city, but they're losing it to house prices. This is the city that's changing, right? They're not losing it to migration. He said, yeah, I get that. So think about what's going on here, right? You've got this event that people are looking on and into describing as far right. It's the week after the Black Lives Matter rally where they pulled down a statue of a slaver. He said to me, I don't care about the statue. But what's happened is guys grew up in this area, they can't afford to live here anymore. But if you don't listen and pull the layers back, you could end up interpreting something as far right. So think about that. The guys grew up in the area, the city's changing around them. It's not simply migration, by the way, it's gentrification. The houses are becoming unaffordable for them. And then you've got this thing in the middle of the city that's symbolic, that's become symbolic of your city's history. And again, gentrifying group of people, identify, rip it down, right? And throw it in the harbor. They're like, I can't afford to live here. They're taking my city away from me. And this is in the aftermath of Brexit, right? So we go and listen. I mean, it was a really interesting time, right? And anyway, we good chatted. But here's another little bit. So his wife come in to make a cup of tea for me and my guys. His wife was a black woman from Zimbabwe, right? And I'd heard about some of the protesters shouting at the guy saying, oh, you racist, this and the other. And the guy said, don't tell my wife I'm racist. She won't be very happy. And it was him. So there's the complexity of the city, all these things going off in multi-dimensions and trying to find a way through. And I guess the point about leadership at that moment in time was, I just felt that you can't just demonize a group of people that are potentially feeding Mars. You have to go and meet and find out what's going on for them. I felt we needed a pressure valve. Interestingly, I was then told that they wrote about me on the fans fight, the firm site on the Monday, my cousin phoned me up. It was all right, it was positive. But you know, just to go out and reach and find out that there are layers behind everything that's going on. It's not always what it might easily present itself as.
True. Thanks very much, Marvin. Well, look, let's open it up in the room and online. Who would like to ask a question first? I see a question right at the back in the middle there, so I'll come to you first.
Hi. I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ. Ask social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Right, so first of all, thank you for being here. I actually saw you speak at the American Embassy last year, so I was really excited to see you on the lineup here. So my question is about the relationships that you're developing with other cities. How does that work, given that the level of autonomy differs from country to country?
So just a background on that. When I was elected, I am an international person, right? So I married in America. My family's Jamaican. Most of them actually Jamaicans, they call them, right? They live in Maryland and Atlanta. Still got a lot of family in Jamaica. My wife's American. My brother married an Indian. My sister married a Swiss. We're a proper international, and I love that existence. And actually, going back to my point about being mixed heritage at the beginning, I react quite viscerally sometimes to people trying to say, hey, what box are we going to stick you in, right? So the internationalism is there, and I bring that to my occupation of the mayoral position, I think. But having said that, I had no idea of the scale and the significance of the international role of that would be required of me as a city leader, right? So, you know, floods in Pakistan, impact on Pakistanis in Bristol, right? Hurricanes in the Caribbean, impact on, you know, Caribbeans. When there was a fuel explosion in Sierra Leone, we have a big Sierra Leone community. And I cannot work for the well-being of the people inside my city's boundaries unless we think about what's going on, you know, in the world. So there's a bit of a, you know, backdrop to that. So, and how that's worked out practically in terms of beginning to work with other cities, I was co-chair of the Global Parliament of Mayors for a few years. I'm a member of the Mayors Migration Council, which is 11 cities initially came together to shape the UN negotiations on the Global Compact on Migration and then the Global Compact on Refugees, because those negotiations had happened at the UN and no one had talked formally to city leaders, even though most migrants, you know, leave cities, travel through cities, settle in cities and move between cities. No one's talked to any mayors. We were not part of that, those negotiations. And myself and Penny, who was the head of the International Office for Bill de Blasio, spoke at the UN there. And what we found was there were around 300 city networks live in the world at the moment. You've got networks like C40, for example, on climate change, who are really working to not just share best practice now, which is important, but to do two other things which are incredibly important. One is to shape global policy so that the international institutions can better work with cities and understand what cities need. But also, what you're finding now are cities are coming together to shape global finance. Because international finance is not of a sort that readily works with cities. And we need finance and we can get it done. So you're finding cities organizing to work with finance. So we're part of that whole kind of move now, with cities. And if I give you a very practical example, so for example, in the UK, we're a founding member of something called 3CI. And it really comes off the back of a piece of work we were doing at with the World Economic Forum. And actually, Greg Clark, again, Professor Clark, who's works with you here, was the guy that kind of really developed it. It was a collaboration between UK Cities Catapult, Core Cities that I was chairing at the time, with 11 biggest cities outside London, London councils, and now it's extended to key cities, Scottish Cities Alliance, and actually the Local Government Association. And we identified a challenge that cities need finance, UK government finance to decarbonize. The UK government is not going to provide that finance, and we need private finance. We know there's private finance out there looking for somewhere to land, but the challenge for cities are on a number of fronts. But amongst the key challenges, do we have the expertise to work up market-ready propositions? I talked about the hollowing out of backroom capacity. So if we come together, can we collectively develop that expertise? Secondly, do we offer scale, right? Individual cities might not offer the scale that's required to attract international private finance, but by working together, we can. And do we offer the variety of investable propositions? So some are hard, some investable propositions are harder to develop than others. But if we come together, we can offer a package that would allow us to work in those international markets. And so we're doing that with this 3CI group. So we've identified a £200 billion pipeline of decarbonisation investment opportunities between us. Now that allows us to move in a very different way if we can collaborate, you know, reaching out to international finance than if we're just operating alone. So again, it comes back to that point. So cities are beginning to move with much more agency. I think what we need is government to catch up with that and begin to support us in that.
Thanks, Martin. Another question right at the back, gentleman, right ahead.
Thanks very much. Can I ask you about policing? Because your counterparts in Manchester and London are essentially the police and crime commissioners for their police forces that are coterminous with their cities. But in Bristol, you're covered by Avon and Somerset Police, and there's a separately elected police and crime commissioner. So how much influence can and should you have, directly or indirectly, on that aspect of public service in the city?
Yeah. So there's a subtle difference. I'm a city mayor, so if you remember back to the referendums that David Cameron ran, he wanted city mayors all over, and Bristol was the only city that in its referendum in 2011 had said yes. I ran in 12, lost. I ran in 16, won. So I'm the only city mayor. Joanne Anderson in Liverpool became city mayors, but all the other cities have leaders, and then think Sheffield's gone for a committee system and Bristol's going for a committee system in May. What can you do? Andy and they are metro mayors, so they've got they got the combined authority. So it's in a slightly different configuration. We do have a police crime commission there. I think that from where I am, our relationship with the police is, I think, is pretty good. If I bring you back to what I talked about at the beginning about convene and ask, the one city approach, because we've brought the police in and we've said, look, what do you need from us to be your best? They buy into that leadership model. So Andy Marsh before was my previous chief constable, Sarah Cruz, my current chief constable. That, the quality of those human relationships are important. And by the way, going back, I mean, I know it's a bit of a well-worn phrase now, culture eats strategy for breakfast and all that sort of stuff. Never underestimate the importance of just having good relationships with people in leadership. I think sometimes sometimes people talk about structure, but you can have a structure and a strategy and a plan, dysfunctional relationships, it will not, it really undermines it. And we've worked incredibly hard at building good, trusting relationships with our, you know, with our fellows and the police, you know, included. And case in point, if any of you saw the documentary series recently on Channel 4, Catch a Copper, I knew that was coming out before. We worked closely with our chief constable. We've absolutely backed, because he's had the bravery to open up the police to some level of insight. So we built the relationship even though we don't have institutional control. But I do think that over the medium to long term, bearing it, you know, if we can get the right geographical areas for governance, that there should be the match between the political office and the you know, leadership and the police. And I know American mayors are pretty shocked when they find out that the mayor doesn't kind of have political leadership over the police. The only thing I'll just add to that, by the way, is that I was on a panel just Monday night, and one of the points is there's not a straight line between devolution and performance. If you devolve powers to dysfunctional, disorganized leadership structures, it will by definition not produce performance. So there's a dance to be done between a government that we think should devolve and local areas getting their act together to have the skills and the foresight and ability to wield those powers and resources. That goes for policing too.
Look, we're just going to go online briefly because can we perhaps take a couple of the questions online? If we've got one, we'll take one and then we'll come back into the room.
The question is from Seb Gallego. How your government is using data, AI and other technology tools to improve citizen experience with the local government and also tackle cybercrime, example, school bullying in the city.
School bullying?
Yeah.
So we actually, it's a very live point at the moment on the use of data. So we've just had a horrific few months in Bristol where we've had a series of stabbings. And when we really began to dive in, one of the questions was, are we using data around where the risks are, what's happening to who, where, when, and why, in the way that we should? Are we gathering the right amount of data? And the data we do have, are we using it as well as we should? And for us, the truth of it was, no. Right? And it comes back to your question, actually. What we found was a disconnect between public health, police, had their own data, and there was a disconnect between using it. And we're meeting on Friday afternoon, actually, to fix this. Right? Well, I don't say we'll fix it in one afternoon, but the idea is that we fix it around an absolutely critical city challenge as well. It doesn't mean that nothing was happening, but it means that we weren't using the data, you know, as well as possible. So it really is an ongoing challenge for us. We are acknowledged to be a smart city, in which there's lots of innovation, going on, in our use of AI and data. To be honest, a lot of it's beyond my scope where this is going. I am a relationships person. I'm like, find me smart people, put them in the same room, and let's see what you come out with. But we do back it. Bristol has developed a bit of reputation. I'll be happy to share more outside of this.
Wonderful, thank you. Let's come back in the room here. I'm going to come perhaps front row here, if I may, and then to the gentleman there, is that right?
Yeah. Hi, thank you so much for your talk so far. I actually work at London Councils in our transport and environment team, and I'm really curious about what learnings we can take from Bristol as London, and I mean that in a very positive way, like what examples should we be following from Bristol?
Examples on transport?
If you like, especially I work in...
I'll take your transport system. Heavily subsidised. Buses, underground. transport has been a massive frustration for me, so I don't know what I would offer in terms of lessons, because we've actually looked to London. The Elizabeth line is a classic for us. I mean, Bristol, we've just had a big, I'm going to say row, but, you know, it's a classic in the city. Bristol historically has failed to grasp the nettle on delivering a transport system for a growing population, an increasingly dense population. And that's happened again. When I first was elected, we were looking at, well, what's the solution on transport? We're a famously congested city, costs us millions of pounds a year. And so we said, actually, the solutions need to be three-dimensional, not just what do we do with the surface of the city, but could we go up and over or under? We plumbed for under, as is London. I think the first underground opened up in the 1860s, we tried to push this, and what you get is this is pie in the sky. It's not deliverable. So we haven't managed to push it through the combined authority, the opposition politics within the city. So we're very frustrated. So we've ended up with what I would describe as a bit of a patch and mend culture around transport. We've rolled out cycle lanes, but again, there's a reality of that. They cost money, and we're trying to roll out cycle lanes in a dense city with confined space, with lots of competition for land, narrow streets that we do have to have people moving around in cars until we have a viable alternative, and at what point do you jump? So I would say actually transport is one of the biggest disappointments for my time in solving. You know, we're doing what other people have done. We're rolling out cycle hangers. We're trying to get money to subsidize bus routes that have been hit incredibly hard by COVID as well. They haven't quite recovered. We struggle with a private bus company within our city as well, which means that the routes have to be commercial. And then they will make commercial decisions over which routes they run. That doesn't mean the local management aren't good. It just means there's a responsibility to shareholders that doesn't always align with the needs, you know, of the city. But ultimately, if you don't have the finances to subsidise those bus routes again, you're not going to get the routes in play. So yeah, I mean, to be honest, we look to London for inspiration. I don't know, Simon. Is there anything you would say London should learn from us? Put you on the spot. Oh yeah, well, and the whole WEF conspiracy, yeah, about locking people into their 15-minute cities. we have gone down a route of trying to introduce liberal neighbourhoods in Bristol. It was bumpy, and the fact I sat on a WEF panel a couple of years ago didn't help probably. So you putting traffic restrictions in and trying to stop rat running has been a challenge. But London's done that too. I guess the key thing is, I'd say one thing that we have talked about, particularly if we're going to introduce restrictions, is, again, be acutely aware that good things can have negative consequences for some people. So when we were introducing our livable neighbourhood in Barton Hill, which is in the top 1% most deprived in England, a lot of heavy concentration Somali communities, I was in a room with one of our transport chiefs, transport officers. You know, how can I describe? He won't know who he is. Delightful young guy, corduroy trousers, bicycle, and he was just talking about how amazing it is to ride a bike. And yet, one of my friends, Muna Abdi, Somali woman, was saying, "That's great, but when you introduce this restriction to movement, this family who has care and responsibility for this elder just thinks I've got to drive further now to get to that older person I care for." And this person who's in the care business, because Muna runs a care company in the city, they have to drive further now to get to their clients. And it takes them another 15 minutes to get to Aldi to do the shop. So for the people who are fantastic about cycling and reducing cars, that is absolutely fantastic. But you end up maybe going into the realm of unjust transition, you know, in the concept of just transition. You know, in the perversities of climate change is it's the poorest, most marginalized who get hit first, who get hit hardest by the consequences of climate change or poor air quality, but they're also most vulnerable to being hit by the negative consequences of the restructuring we have to go through. And if you don't take account of those negative costs, you can end up losing the dressing room. And then you lose the democratic mandate to deliver the scale of change at the pace it needs to be delivered. And I guess one of the, if we are going to do anything, community development at the front end of any major intervention is absolutely essential. And our own officers haven't always taken that into account.
So my learning here is it's already much more difficult than any of these online computer games. Do you want to run your own city? it seems that, the transport bit on that always seems so straightforward. The gentleman there in the middle, sorry.
Hello. Could you please name one policy for which you've been criticised the most by your opponents?
And by my residents?
By your opponents.
Oh, by my opponents.
Political opponents. Well, and one policy which you couldn't deliver and was most frustrated by?
Well, the one that got me a lot of heat was an arena. My favourite topic. So I inherited, Bristol's wanted an arena for decades. no one's delivered it. And then when I took over in 2016, I inherited plans to build a £110 million arena on a piece of land in the middle of the city, just behind the train station, Temple Meads. And I don't think I should name the companies, but we had always a big company employed to deliver it. Well, you know, you start to test the model and it's not 110, it's 180 million. So we go back out to market because we want to deliver it on this piece of land. We bring in another company, comes in at 160 million. And by that time, this piece of land in the middle of the city, we do a value for money assessment, and we find out that if we don't build the arena, so everyone wants the arena, right? This is symbolic, it's massive, got to get us an arena, we'll bring world-class acts to Bristol, it's a big economic boost, all the rest of it. You know, anyone who's run a city knows that sports venues and arenas and stadiums do not deliver the boost. They're more symbolic and, you know, than they are economically helpful. But we find out through a value for money assessment that that piece of land that we own as a city, if we do not build an arena, but instead do a mixed development, including homes, hotel, conferencing, and retail, it delivers three times the number of jobs, three times the GVA, gross value added to the economy, and about 2.5 times the tax revenue every year. So we get to a point where, again, in the office, Kevin, my chief of staff, I'm in the US, we've been with family on holiday, and we've done all the work, and he says, well, Marvin, you can make the political decision or the right decision. The political decision is we can press go, build the arena, right? We can build the arena. What do you want to do? and I said, well, we can't build the arena. And then, Simon, I don't want to put you in a spot here. Like you were saying, what the heck have you done? You're going to lose the next election. And the opponents jumped on it, right? You promised us an arena. It was in your manifesto. You should build the arena. City needs it. It will uphold. Even one of my MPs, Labour MP, is on the front page of the paper. You've just abandoned my part of the city. You've lost us jobs and all that. And we're saying, look at the evidence. The evidence says we'll get more jobs. We'll get more. It's the city's land. We get to use this land once. And that got me a lot of criticism. I will say, though, there wasn't a sensible person in the country that, outside of that heat, that believed we should build the arena. There's another little bit that I love sharing. So the financial model of the arena was this. We borrow £160 million and we build this building on this piece of land. We don't run the arena. Then we contract a company in to run it. That company they make profit from running the arena. And then from that profit, they pay us rent. We use that rent to pay our debt repayments. So it's a circle. There's only two things in that circle that cannot disappear, right? The physical arena and our debt repayments. Everything else can disappear. So I said the margins were too small. So if anything got in the way of that arena making money, right, we'll be stuffed. So that was 2017, right? We could have pressed go. We'd have been finishing the arena just at the end of 2019. What happened? What happened in an interview? Well, I said in the interview, well, we called it right. He said, yeah, but you didn't pick the pandemic, did you? You didn't predict the pandemic. I said, no, I didn't. But I predicted that something might get in the way of the arena making money. And it did. We didn't get any credit for that. It was ultimately successful, but we're still criticised for it. If you go on my social media, let people say... Sorry? Something that I haven't achieved that I'm really unhappy about? Cleaning up the city streets. It's been a pain for me. I came in, I had dreams of Zurich levels of street cleanliness. And we have not achieved that. And again, that's a frustration, by the way, when you talk about your tools not always working for you. You know, rubber handles, they call it, or broken levers. I've pulled in senior people who were responsible to me for rubbish and waste in the city. I said three things. I want to clean the streets, but that is a gateway. Clean streets is a gateway, but I want you to look at the whole waste system for our city. Again, big issue for cities. Don't see waste as an afterthought. Waste, you should be stepping into city leadership to reduce the generation of waste in the first instance, bring maximum efficiency to the processing of waste and maximizing reuse and recycling, right? That's what I want you to do. And that takes structural change, it takes cultural change. I said to the leaders, very well paid, I said, do you know how to do that? Right? Look me in the eye. They said, yes, we do. The truth is, no, they didn't. And so, and then what happens sometimes in political leadership, and I'm just talking to Simon about what I would do next time. Sometimes it's like a boiling frog, you know, this concept, you know, you put a frog in boiling water and you don't know it's failed until it's too late. And to be perfectly honest, you kind of, you see initiatives going on and you're getting reports coming in. And again, a mentor of mine said to me once, when you're at the senior level of leadership, you have to maintain your connectivity to the front line. Because as reports work their way up through the organization, they get doctored so that by the time it starts as bad news, by the time it gets to you as a leader, it's good news, right? And that's what's happening. I'm getting these reports, but I could see it's not working. I'm raising it. Now I'm at the end of my time and I look at it and yes, things have happened, but I'm incredibly unhappy about that we didn't achieve what I really wanted to achieve.
And just as an aside, I remember going to the office of the mayor of Karachi about 16 years ago, and he had a big flat screen TV in his office, and he said, do you like my TV? And I thought he was sort of asking me to admire his accoutrements in his office. And I said, well, yes. And he turned it on, but instead of a TV show, it was basically a live feed from a call center in Karachi about urban problems in the city, and color-coded each line. Basically, is it being dealt with? Is it not being dealt with? Is it not actually something a city can help with at all? So that sense of data and data science may also be a help on some of this stuff.
We try to do that.
We're getting squeezed on time, so I'm going to suggest, if that's all right, Marvin, if you're happy, but we take two questions at a time as we go now. So the gentleman here and then the gentleman behind, yeah.
You've mentioned the housing crisis in Bristol before, and I've seen an article saying that Bristol rents are the second fastest growing in the UK outside of London. If you hypothetically had, you know, unlimited power as mayor, how would you address the housing crisis?
My question is around the clean air zone in Bristol, because I'm writing my dissertation on it. But I'm writing it on the Manchester one. So, obviously, clean air zones benefit through for the environment, but also for reducing inequality within a city. So do you think that having a charging clean air zone actually achieves those goals? Or are you looking at Manchester's approach to having a non-charging clean air zone as a possibility for Bristol or for the West of England combined authority?
So housing, there's a fundamental truth. We have to build homes and we have to build affordable homes. And I mean genuinely affordable, for rent and for purchase. So there's a backdrop to this, and as I said, we've really driven on building homes, and I actually paid a political price for building homes, even in a, interestingly, and I will, maybe I'll cross the line here, but I actually went for selection recently in the Labour Party, and one of the lines about me was I wanted to build tall buildings everywhere, and that was one of the attacks on me. I'm like, I'm in the Labour Party, we're supposed to be building homes, and I've paid a price for that commitment to house building. So we need the stock. We've just recently had to decant a whole tower block because we've, you know, when the engineer's report said it wasn't safe. And some of the people are saying, well, we want priority housing. Everyone who's taken out wants to be put top of the housing waiting list. And I said, you know, the campaign that's run, I said to them, you're running a campaign as though we've got a stash of houses that we're not giving out. We literally don't have any houses, hence 22,000 people on the waiting list. So that's a real challenge for us. So building homes is absolutely, you know, essential. We need for that, we need resource. We need political support to make that done. And we need finance, private finance, public finance. And I've said to developers as well, one of the things that you can do as developers is rather than just complaining about planning not happening fast enough, you need to make the case to national government that they need to invest in the capacity of local government to process systems, right? And, you know, it was nice. There was a warmth. There was a warmth to that. Because whoever defends local government? No one. But everyone wants what local government does. And we do need an intervention in the private rental sector, right? That's, the truth of it. Now, there's ups and downs to rent controls. People will say, well, it distorts the market and causes people to take their... It can actually lead to a withdrawal of homes from the rental sector. So I'm not denying there's complexity. But what I am saying is the wild west of housing isn't working. And the consequences of that for us are not confined to housing. The consequences of a failure in housing turn up in our mental health services, they turn up in the criminal justice system, they turn up in the likelihood of political extremism or vulnerabilities to it, as I talked about earlier. They turn up in social tensions, family breakdown, school performance, productivity of the economy, if we're not getting the best from our populations because they haven't got a stable home. And again, just in terms of we made housing central to us, I'll finish it. I was at an athletics event and I was stood next to a head teacher for a primary school. And we were just chatting about his students. And he said, if I could just do one thing for my students, I would make sure every child had a kitchen table. Right? Now, to me, that was obviously the kitchen table is symbolic. It's a home. It's stable, it's physical space to do work and to pursue an education. If you don't have those things, you're not going to get the Marmot type principle, every child get enough to the best possible start in life. A nice little thing, I was on the Archbishop of Canterbury's Housing Commission, and the Bishop of Kensington also added a really nice thing about human dignity. What's the purpose of housing? Also to be hospitable. If you can have a home in which you can offer hospitality, you can build community. And we know today increasingly about the importance of the significance of loneliness to population sickness, which costs us money as well. So housing is the issue for me. In terms of the CAS, it has actually worked. Is it 10% reduction in nitrous oxide in the city? Air quality has improved. But I'll share with you, I had Extinction Rebellion took to the roof of City Hall. I rode my bike in one day, luckily I had ridden in that day, and I came in here on the roof, demanding I meet them. I just said, if you want to meet me, do what everyone else does, send me an email. I'm not going to respond to you because you're on my roof. You know? So anyway, I go in and they spend like four nights on the roof, or five nights, wherever it was, and they're demanding I introduce a clean air zone. Now, we were going to introduce a clean air zone, but I'm not going to respond to that kind of toddlerish behavior. So I didn't confirm to them we were going to introduce a clean air zone. But what was happening in the background was our negotiations with national government. So obviously you know the background, right? Client Earth were threatening national government with legal action. National government rolled it down onto the shoulders of local government. My point to Therese Coffey at the time, and I had a couple of Zooms with her, because they said, you're missing your deadlines on the clean air zone. I said, we're not. What we're acutely aware of is that if you just introduce a clean air zone, including charging, which ours has to do because of the geography of the city, you're going to disadvantage some people. What about households? What about small businesses? And in fact, because the clean air zone went straight outside the hospital, what about the hospital? All right? She said, well, you've got to do the clean air zone. In the end, we managed to get a £42 million package of support to support people through the transition in the point of a just transition. All right? So people have been able to change their cars, take alternative, travel modes. So it has worked, but I'm saying there has to be a financial package to support people through the transition. Otherwise, the price people pay for that solution is high, and it will fall disproportionately on the shoulders of the most vulnerable people. If I just share one quick story, I'll try to be good. Five Live, before the Clean Air Zone was introduced, before we announced it, I was on Five Live, and they were saying, you're missing all your deadlines. And I said, no, we're not. What about small businesses, households, and hospital? They said, well, you're missing your deadlines. We announced our Clean Air Zone, and literally about 3 months later, I'm on the same program. They said, what about small businesses and households? Seriously. I said to them, you should listen to the interview I did with you about 3 months ago, because all you're asking me is what I said back then. And it's that kind of catchier, journalism that really undermines our ability to have a sophisticated conversation with the city. Because the first story was all about not you're taking care of people in the transition. The first story was you're failing. The second story was supposed to be you're hurting poor people. Well, we were doing both at the same time. Well, we weren't failing. We were trying taking care of people while introducing the Clean Air Zone in both instances. It's just that the journalistic angle on it changed and the kind of consequences to the population changed. So it really undermined our ability to navigate that journey well. Well, so clean air zones are off the peg, right? Because they obviously include different categories of vehicles. We've gone for a D. Yeah, we've gone for a CAS D, which charges private cars. If we did not charge private cars and only charge commercial vehicles, our clean air zone would have had to be massive, because we'd have had to impact on more commercial vehicles to make up for the private vehicles that were not being impacted. So, again, here you get the conversation, right? So people say, but Manchester ain't charging. Our topography is different, so the way air moves around a city is different. So a CAS C that did not charge private cars would have incorporated a whole trading estate, right, that has working class jobs in it. So some of those lorry deliveries for gas, there's a gas company that delivers Cala gas bottles. They'd have been charged 100 quid every time their lorry went in and out. Business would have been finished. So by going for charging private cars, we could actually shrink the area of our clean air zone so it didn't impact on those jobs, and that was really tight around the middle of the city. So it really is, there's very little choice. You plug your numbers in and it tells you what you got to do. But once clean air zones are not congestion charges, so once people have transitioned their vehicles, you will no longer need a clean air zone, because you won't have the vehicles that are not Euro 6 diesel or Euro 4 petrol. So you won't have the vehicles driving out the levels of pollution that Clean Air Zone is designed to intervene with.
Okay, let's take two more questions in the room, if we may. So, and we've got one online. So can I suggest we take two questions in the room and one online? Can I suggest this lady here, the gentleman there, if that's all right, and then we'll take the question online afterwards. So can we get a mic to the lady here? I think this may end up being our last round, but we'll see how we get on.
Thank you so much. You've talked a lot about contradictory opinions that are very passionately held, and I'm just very curious about how you bring all of those different opinions on the table in the form of, for example, policy networks, to successfully implement those networks and find a common ground where you please the majority, but you also uphold the rights of the most vulnerable population of your city. Because you have to make decisions, like you mentioned, like tall buildings versus sprawl. But how do you do that in a way that pleases everyone the most? So if you could talk a little bit about that, that would be cool. Also, I have a question for you. You mentioned the mayor of Karachi, and I'm from Karachi, so which mayor were you talking about? Because I have a lot of opinions about all the mayors that have ever served that city.
Can I suggest we take the Karachi one offline, but we'll come back to it. Can I suggest passing it back there? That's great, thanks.
Thank you. Fascinating talk. My question is really, if we fast forward 5 decades or so, and urbanization, perhaps the rate of urbanization perhaps increases, and more people live in cities, and the complexities that cities have, and the short-term nature of your funding, do you think a model whereby the city mayor is elected for 5 to 10 years effectively is a benevolent dictator with 100% control of the budget? Is that possibly the only answer going forward?
Okay, thank you very much. So rather than Judge Dredd, do we need Mayor Dredd, as it were, as the solution on this? And we've got one question online.
Question from Anthony Vallion. It seems in London there is a rise in people criticizing Israel's actions, as well as a rise in people defending Israel's actions. How is Bristol keeping the peace between communities?
Okay.
Over to you. Okay. So bringing people together. First off, sometimes you can't, right? I think we many people will recognize that there's a form of public debate today in which people are not listening. Everyone's on transmit. I guess one of the challenges I've made to people is, even within my own party, sometimes it seems like people have a list of criteria, and it says, if you do not see the way the world, the way I see it, think about it the way I think about it, see the challenges and opportunities that I see and strategize and plan to tackle them in the way that I plan, I'm just going to say you're evil. And you have to meet all of those criteria to even, exist. And I think that's really come home to me being as mayor, where we have to compromise, we have to be pragmatic, you have to get stuff done, and then this constant judgment. I'm not moaning about that. I'm just saying you see evidence of it, and that we're at the middle of it. Sometimes you can't bring people together. I think what I would say is, in terms of bringing where we have brought, I guess I call on my background, my mixedness, my transition from welfare kid, poor kid, to university kid, to mayor. I guess I bring some of that to it, that sometimes you just have to live with things you don't feel comfortable with. So Colston statue, again, if I go back to that, right? I think we have held the floor whereby even if people didn't get what they want, they feel respected. So this is the way we did it, right? What do you do with the statue, right? The statue's in the bottom of the dock. We needed to get that statue out. We didn't want it being like the resurrection on the third day with hundreds of people clapping as it raised out the water. So we snuck down there at 5 a.m. a few days later. Sky News, fair play to Sky, they were there, they filmed it. Then we put it in the museum. And then we did two things. We launched a history commission. And what we said was, we got professional historians, Professor Tim Cole from Bristol University, David Olusuga joined it for a while as well, Professor Sean Shobus from UWE. We got historians to work around and run a consultation on the city on what we should do. Who was Colston? So what Colston was then presented to Bristol lads was not the result of Twitter or noise or lobby. It was historians looking at the evidence. Almost dispassionate, you know? And then with that information, we put the statue on display in the M shed in the museum. And here was a debate. What we didn't want, there was a statue lying in state. But we needed to respect the statue because there are Bristolians who so identify with Colston. And by the way, there's a lot of history to that. The statue of Colston wasn't put up till 170 years after he died. The mythology around Colston was created for the working class Bristolians to try and settle them down, to create almost a founding father, and it worked, right? So we needed to respect the statue, but not have the statue lying in state while running this consultation. And we ended up with 13,000 people respond to the consultation. We decided to put the statue in a museum. Some people wanted the statue put on the plinth. It's actually not possible to put it on the plinth because the base is damaged. But actually, I think we came through it quite remarkably. In all of that heat, we held it together. We did have one intervention that wasn't welcome, a real posh, and I don't mind you repeating that, sculptor from London came down and stuck his own statue on the plinth. I told him not to. He put a statue of a black woman up on the plinth, and I said, well, it's a nice offer, but remember, we have black and Asian families in parts of the city that if you put a spark in this heated environment, they're the ones who are going to end up with dog poo put through the door and their windows smashed. Put a statue up anyway, against our advice. What happened? We had a spike in hate crime. All right? So outside of that intervention, I think we managed it and held people together. And I think you go back to the point I made earlier on. Even if we're going to say no, you need to know you were respected and you were heard. But as adults, we know this is the world that sometimes says no. And you just have to come to terms with that. And don't expect politicians to put you in another world in which you can always get a yes. Do I think city leaders should be dictators? Well, that's one of the arguments made around the mayoralty in Bristol, which is why Bristol had a referendum and decided to go for a committee system. The argument being that a city can't be run by one person with all the power who's unaccountable. Silly arguments, you know. I don't have all the power, the universities, health system, private sector, and all that. I don't
I think certainly as urbanization becomes, you know, as more people live in cities, there has to be a shift to city leadership. And the way I've come to it, you know, global governance needs to move into its next iteration. And I think it is about iterations. And that has to be one in which city leaders and leaders of networks of cities are more equal partners in shaping national and international policy. If that change doesn't happen, I think we're going to carry on with this kind of disconnect, this dislocation between this growing political economic reality of these massive concentrations of people in these urban centres who, and national governments, sometimes with rurally elected leaders making decisions about things over which they have no experience and no contact. That disconnect, if we may be able to survive it, but it will lead to a chronic underperformance nationally, and I think that's what we get at the moment, or it will lead to increasing friction. And by the way, I think the very nature of cities, the density, the dynamism and diversity, being disconnected from national leaders who are talking in terms of borders and one-dimensional identities, right? When cities are multidimensional and post-national in many ways. I think that's a disconnect that we have to find a way of solving if it's not going to become an increasing problem. Dictatorship, I don't know. I think you can have local accountability. What's happened around Israel and Palestine, that was real for us. We went through a really challenging time. I was at the Labour Party conference, and I got a message saying the Home Secretary has asked all public buildings to be lit up in blue and white. And I said, okay. Full disclosure on how we navigated it. I said, all right, well, is everyone doing it? They said, everyone's doing it. I said, okay. It's an atrocity. We want to say something. Can we find a way of putting some language around that that says, this is absolutely heinous and is unacceptable? Can we find a language that says there's context as well? But can we find a language that says there's context without saying this is heinous, but that, you know, people deserved it? We couldn't find a language to just acknowledge the atrocity, of it, and do context and complexity at the same time. So we lit City Hall up, and then faced a vicious, you know, real big backlash within Bristol. So then I convened. I had Muslim, Jewish, and Christian leaders come together. We had a conversation around, what do we do around this? Now, within that conversation, there was obviously a lot of back and forth. It was very emotional and quite rightly, understandably so. What we got to is a point where we said, all right, well, we'll do something else symbolic. We're going to project onto City Hall the words peace, shalom, shalom, in Hebrew and Arabic as well. So we projected onto that, you know, bringing our religious communities in to try and make a statement about our commitment as a city to be in a city of peace in which we live together. Now, that's not a naive peace. It's not a peace that says, you know, we're just going to sit around a campfire irrespective of what's happening around us and just pretend everything's easy. But it was about, a commitment to try and live together in the face of all the difficulty, and the complexity with which we were in. And that's how we've tried to hold it together. I did also, as a politician, it's one thing I do say to faith leaders a lot, by the way, is I said, you need to come up with the solutions for this, right? I'm a politician trying to solve these issues. You're faith leaders. And I don't mean this facetiously, but it is a little bit. You claim to have access to supernatural power. If you are coming as genuine faith leaders, come in to a broken world with your power, with your insights, and guide us through and show us how to solve it. Don't just sit there and be part of the people that throw stones into a complex world. And actually, to fair to our faith leaders, they really stepped into that space and have worked incredibly hard to do it. So it's not just me, it's about how we challenge the people to live together as well.
So Marvin, thank you. We're nearly out of time. It wouldn't be right if I didn't ask Marvin the question, the TikTok question, which is, Marvin, what next?
Lots of things, I think. So I finish as mayor in May, 8 years. It'll be an interesting time. You know, we're now just on the trying to land well. A whole bunch of things. I've got a book in August. I've actually put my hat in the ring for UN Habitat, next exec director of UN Habitat. We'll see what goes on there. I'm told lots of politics involved, but hey, what do you do? Put yourself forward, see what happens. And obviously, I've come and visited here as well. There's a great work going on training city leaders here, doing some work with University of Bristol. I'm really keen to stay in the space of understanding what cities are, thinking about what we need them to be, and then thinking how we get them there, both in terms of the policy support, the policy space, the global structure around them, and what leadership is needed to help cities become the fullness of what they can be for all of our goods, not just for their own good, but because I think if we get cities right, the world will be in a much better place. If we get cities wrong, they're going to be a global liability.
Well, thank you very much. I'm going to invite Tony Travers, Professor Tony Travers, my colleague in the School of Public Policy, and actually a far better expert on cities. He's the guru on London. Tony, do you want to make any final remarks before we close?
Well, thank you very much, both of you. I suppose the obvious thing to ask the mayor of a major city is, I mean, I think policy in any country, including the UK, is made by parliamentarians of all parties, many of whom, let's say, are of fear, don't really understand big cities. The concept of Middle England or Middle Britain tends to be about a smallish town. Yeah, yeah. And then there are large numbers of people, very articulate, who live in the countryside. So working with other mayors, and you alluded to the core cities and London councils, how would you sort of best advise your co-mayors and city leaders to ensure public policy towards cities reflects the particular and often unique needs of cities compared with the sort of medium-sized town in the Midlands?
Well, the first is, after doing this for 8 years, we can't ensure it, right? There has to be a listening ear. And to be perfectly frank, we haven't found that in any real strength. I was at the House of Lords for an event just a couple of weeks ago with Michael Heseltine, Greg Clark. Both Greg Clarks were there, this Greg Clark and Conservative Greg Clark. Kerry McCarthy was there. And you know, it felt like a fringe event. And yet you had core cities represented, metro mayors represented. That was there. We were there with Andy Haldane from the Urban Futures Commission. And we were just, socialising the work we did. So there has to be a listening ear. There has to be a government. But it's one of the reasons that in the Urban Futures Commission, we started off with the section on what are cities. And there are a number of things. We want to put evidence on the table. It's not just putting our hands up and saying, please listen to us. And we want to put evidence on the table at just how significant cities are to the national culture, economy, and politics. Now, if you look at the evidence and understand how significant they are, you have to start making decisions about what you're going to do with them. And at the moment, it feels like we got the evidence, but people don't see that evidence. And so they don't have to make any decisions about using these things called cities, hence they don't bring them into play. So, but what we have done with core cities in the way that we've communicated as well is turn up with solutions. So it's constant, so for example, there's a number flying around with core cities that if the UK core cities were at the levels of productivity of their European counterparts, it's an extra £103 billion a year to the UK economy. How can you leave that untapped on the table, right? Off the table. So, we've tried to turn up like that. The other thing that we tried to do with that evidence, by the way, is to get beyond this nonsensical towns versus city debate. Interestingly, the week after we published the Urban Futures Commission, the Prime Minister came out and said, we've listened too much to cities, we must do more towns. I mean, it's a city. It's not towns or cities, it's towns and cities, and it's towns and cities and villages. And it's, again, working with that interdependence, rather than trying to get the nation to trade off against each other in the name of cheap political popularity. So I guess what we've tried to do is get beyond that binary either or debate and put the hard evidence on the table and then work with that.
Wonderful. Well, look, thank you all very much. Can we put our hands together and thank Marvin for giving up his time to come to us? And can I thank all those, both who turned up in the room and those online, and a particular shout out to the LSE events staff who made this evening possible. Thanks all very much. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favourite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.